Hello, and today is Tuesday, November 25th, 2014, and I am here with Mr. David Blaskowitz in the Detroit West Conference Room on the 17th floor of the Renaissance Center building at 600 Renaissance Center in Detroit, Michigan. My name is Adam Mosseri, and I will be conducting today's oral history interview with Mr. Blaskowitz as the interviewer. As a part of today's interview, we will be discussing Mr. Blaskowitz's involvement with Detroit Renaissance and the City of Detroit. Whenever you are ready.
What would you like me to say?
My first question is, when and where were you born?
I was born in Detroit in 1968, June 3rd, our fair city, and stayed in the region my entire life.
What were your parents' names?
My father is Raymond Blaskowitz. My mother is Rosemary Blaskowitz. Her maiden name was Rosemary De Laurentiis. Father's 100% Polish. My mother's 100% Italian, and both grew up in the city of Detroit.
Could you please spell your mother's maiden name?
De Laurentiis. D-E capital L-A-U-R-E-N-T-I-I-S.
Thank you. When and where were you born?
I was born June 3rd, 1968, and I was born in the city of Detroit. I believe it was Children's Hospital, but you know, honestly, I don't know exactly if that's the case, but I believe that's the case.
Do you happen to know where are all of the places that you lived in Michigan as a child before you came to the city of Detroit?
Yes. So I started off, we lived in Inkster, city western suburb of the city of Detroit, and I lived there till I was about 15 years old. We moved to Dearborn Heights at that point. I lived there with my parents until I graduated high school. Within a couple of days after graduating high school, I moved to Forest and Third on Wayne State's campus and lived there for a couple of years. I moved after that to the Keene Building, which is located on Jefferson, east side of Detroit. Had a short stint in Ferndale, and right before I got married, moved back home for a short period of time, save a few dollars, and then got married, bought our first place in Plymouth. And then from Plymouth, we moved to, our first place was actually an apartment in Northville. Then we moved to Plymouth, and then from Plymouth to Novi. My wife has a part of our marriage covenant that says I have to live within 4 miles of my mother-in-law. And so as part of that process, she lives in Northville. We've pretty much run a ring around her at this point. So terrific woman, by the way, for the record. She is a wonderful, wonderful woman.
And what is your in-law's name, since you've mentioned them?
My mother-in-law, her name is Angie, Angie McKnight.
Could you please spell McKnight?
M-C capital K-N-I-G-H-T.
Thank you very much. How old were you when you began working for Detroit Renaissance?
Well, let's see. I began working for Detroit Renaissance when I was 22 years old. I had spent the first 4 years out of high school in college part-time and working for the parade company in special events. And in, I think it was April of 1990, I had quit my job at the parade company with the intent of accelerating my now 4-year part-time program for my bachelor's. Wanted to step that up. It was within a day or so of putting in my notice that I received a call from Detroit Renaissance. At the time, in 1990, they were still operating a whole series of special events, including the Detroit Jazz Festival. They were doing the Detroit Grand Prix and the Freedom Festival and fireworks at the time. And I was asked to come over on a contract basis to do some work for the Detroit Grand Prix. After completing that work, I spent more time here doing events. I just kind of carried over into the Freedom Festival and fireworks. And then after that, they asked me to stay on for another contract for the Montreux Detroit Jazz Festival. And before I knew it, I was spending, you know, basically all of my time at Detroit Renaissance. There was a change in 1992/93 where they began to go through essentially a reorganization of Detroit Renaissance. New leadership, Bob McCabe was retiring, and new leadership was identified and started in the tail end of 1992. A guy by the name of Bob Keller, who had worked for in Baltimore on their revitalization strategy, was hired by Detroit Renaissance, by the board, to come in and to refocus, if you will, the agenda around three things: economic development, physical development, and public policy.
You had mentioned a Mr. Bob McCabe. Could you please explain what his position title was and what he did at the
Sure. Bob was the president and CEO. I don't know if that's exactly correct. He might have been an executive director, but he was the head of Detroit Renaissance. Detroit Renaissance was, I think, formally created in 1970, but it was in 1972 when it really got its legs. Bob McCabe had worked for the federal government. I believe it was through housing or through HUD. He was brought on by the group that was formed of CEOs here in the area early on, like I said, 1972, and was in that position really for the next 20 years.
What was the type of work that you were responsible for while working for Detroit Renaissance?
Well, it started off that I was essentially in operations related to special events. So I helped to build the racetrack when we had a racetrack in the downtown area. I worked on operations related to the Freedom Festival, the fireworks, and the Montreux Detroit Jazz Festival. Which was everything from managing food and beverage pieces to entertainment components and the like. I had done that for a couple of years, for 3 years, from 1990 through 1992 when Bob Keller showed up. His instructions to us on the operating team was to find good homes for the events. At that time, Bob McCabe had been working on finding a new home for the Detroit Grand Prix. I believe it was IMG that picked up that, which is a marketing company, that picked up that that event. And we were in the process of finding good homes for the Jazz Festival and the Freedom Festival and fireworks. Ultimately, the Jazz Festival was placed with Music Hall, and the Freedom Festival fireworks were placed with the parade company. Today, the Jazz Festival, I think, is independent of Music Hall, but they're both still operating here, which we're really excited about. And the fact that that the Grand Prix is back is also terrific. It moved to the island. I'm bouncing around here, forgive me, but moved to the island. I believe it was in 1992, so for 92 and 93 it ran a couple of years on the island. It may have even been 1991, but it was terrific to see all of those things continue on. Again, the internal focus of the organization was on economic development, physical development, and public policy, so a whole new agenda was created around those activities in 1993.
What drew you towards applying for a position to work for Detroit Renaissance?
So I never really applied for a position. Great question. I wish it had been that formal, but my my own personal life has been one of serendipity. I started here doing these event contracts, and the way I got hired, when Bob Keller came on, he asked me, as we were working on finding good homes for the events, he asked me to write a white paper on stadium funding, and I had worked with a gentleman by the name of Glenn Lapin on that particular piece. And then he'd asked me to write another paper on transportation funding, and had put that piece together. Shortly after that, Bob had come into my office and said, like the work, why don't you just stay on? We'll make you a special projects person. And timing was fantastic because I was just finishing up my my undergrad at Wayne State. So I just stayed on through that period. Wasn't long after that, had another visit by Bob in the office. Every time he showed up, new things would happen. And on this visit, he said, what do you know about accounting? And I said, I know how much I don't like it, you know, as a general category. He said, well, you got a day and a half to learn the system. We just let the bookkeeper go. And at this point, you know, I was a little panicked, but worked my way through the process. I thoroughly screwed it up and then figured it out. And after a little period of time, I got that managed. He came back in and said, I'd like you to take on basically our treasury management responsibilities and the administrative responsibilities for organizations. So I became the secretary and treasurer of the company. And just kind of worked in that capacity as their director of finance and you know, secretary of treasurer, you know, for a number of years. Essentially, that's probably the 94, 95 time frame, all the way up until 2001.
If you remember, where were you working prior to coming to work for Detroit Renaissance?
So I was at the Parade Company, had spent almost 4 years, I guess it was 4 years. I graduated in 1986, spent from right after graduation from high school, I spent my time at the Parade Company. There were a couple odds and end jobs that I had prior to that. I worked for a carpenter. I worked for a carpet cleaning and installation company, you know, just the usual you know, manual labor type jobs for a period of time. But really, not a great deal of experience outside of that.
You had mentioned a Mr. Bob Keller and a Mr. Glenn Lapin.
Yes.
Could you please explain what their positions were in the organization and what they did?
Sure. So Bob Keller came in as Bob McCabe was retiring and assumed the role as president and CEO of Detroit Renaissance. Again, may or may not be the exact title, but that's essentially he was the lead of the organization, led the staff, and you know, obviously reported to the board of Detroit Renaissance on the agenda. Glenn Lapin was a employee of Detroit Renaissance, and Glenn's background was in urban planning. Had taken on a variety of different roles related to community and economic development, physical development in particular. Had worked on the creation of some creative loan programs, pre-development in particular, and had just been a longtime member of Detroit Renaissance.
What was the very first project you worked on as an employee of Detroit Renaissance?
So my first, well, it depends on if we're saying as a contract employee or as an employee employee. As a contract employee, it was special events. And the very first event I participated in was the Detroit Grand Prix. So that in 1990 was my first race. We were still racing on the streets of downtown Detroit. And so I worked on building the track in the downtown area. My first professional role with the organization was really around project management, and it started with writing some white papers on transportation and on stadium funding.
What did these projects mean for the city of Detroit and to you as working on these projects?
Well, transportation, you know, I got a shelf full of transportation studies that show basically all the same thing. We have horrible public transit in the city of Detroit. And so I'm not sure that any of the work that we did to summarize all of this other work, you know, or the fact that we created a positioning paper advance the ball necessarily. Everybody recognizes that as a challenge. I think what we were trying to do is get the team and the board in particular focused on that as a strong opportunity. Stadium funding, again, this significantly predates the construction of Comerica Park, but it was along the lines of building new infrastructure, having that seated in a central district of the downtown, and as obviously that's kind of where it ended up. I strongly doubt that my white paper on stadium funding, moved the needle significantly. I think the direction was already chosen, and things were moving in that direction. It was really, again, an opportunity to begin to focus particular elements of financing around making that happen. So that's glad to have been engaged in the process, but doubt seriously that that had any real impact on the momentum.
Do you remember how long these projects took?
The projects themselves, I mean, the papers themselves were just, within, I'll say several weeks, maybe within a couple of months. There's obviously research and best practices and looking at other examples around the country, and that's fairly typical for what we do when we're trying to get a good sense of future direction. But that would be about it. Now, when you start looking at the implementation around the outputs, those are years in the making. And one of the things that we've learned over time is that you really do need to be tenacious, and you need to have that patience in this town. I think everybody likes to believe that their town is unique. I think there are certain qualifications, to working in this town. If you want to be successful, and one of those is tenacity. So I just think patience and tenacity are, they may sound counterbalanced, but I think you need both of those.
What do you think makes Detroit unique?
Well, there's a lot. I think there's a number of things that make Detroit unique. One is its people. I would just start with the resilience of the population here, and even if I can say it this way, the grittiness of its population. It's the tenacity of the people that are here. That's a special feature, and one of the reasons why I think we're beginning to see the resurgence that we're seeing today is that, I saw a great t-shirt that said Detroit versus everyone, and that's sometimes what it feels like, but it really does have special people here that that are really committed to this community and are going to see this be ultimately successful and just have no other option in their framing. There are other things, though, I think that make Detroit maybe not wholly unique, but certainly special. The level of corporate engagement that we have here and the level of philanthropy that we see in this community have been absolutely terrific. Having the quote-unquote big three, great start, but today we're spending a lot of time talking about DTE Blue Cross and their commitments to campuses here. We certainly are talking a lot about Dan Gilbert and his investment in this community. There are just folks willing to sometimes defy gravity, to defy logic on its face, but certainly have their own logic or approach to investment. Some of them economic, some of them other, and I think that those communities make it special. I think on the downside, and this has changed, but I think on the downside, the lack of strong political direction or clarity on prioritization from the public sector. And this is wholly my opinion on that, has made it challenging. If we wanted to look at investment in the neighborhoods as an example, it became very difficult to have any sense of what the priorities were in particular neighborhoods, what neighborhoods were priorities from the city's perspective, A lot of that has changed. And again, you see the community coming together and circling around particular pieces. One plan in particular that I would point out would be the Detroit Future City plan, which was released in 2012. But here you have the public sector, the private sector, and the philanthropic community all working on an output document that began to look at Detroit and its decline. You know, mid-50s, we were 1.8, almost 1.9 million people. You know, today we're around 700,000. And on that basis, we've lost wealth, we've lost population, we've lost retail, we've lost commercial, manufacturing, you know, just kind of across the board, we've lost a number of things. So as you begin to think about rebuilding city, how do you really construct that? This is where the strong public sector really comes into play. And again, this is, goes back to its people and its community and engagement. I think that having a strong private sector, a strong philanthropic community, and then working with the public sector led to this particular output. Today, we have Mayor Duggan, who has, in his own right, you know, proven his strength and folks' desire to see some change. You know, here we have a write-in candidate that did incredibly well through the voting process, but is just an absolute leader when it comes to setting future priorities. And I think we're all very excited. We're still in the honeymoon phase, and so everybody's excited, right? But we're all very excited about the prospects of the future because we're seeing real discipline being added to the prioritization around the geography. I mean, keeping in mind, Detroit is a very large city. It's 140 square miles, nearly 138 and change. And to try to take all that on simultaneously is a remarkable challenge. So, you know, having having that approach is really important. You can't take everything on simultaneously and you won't be successful. So as far as what makes us unique, I think that those are probably the biggest pieces. I think it's also important to note what doesn't make us unique. If you look at other cities, we just spent some time with the mayor's team and others down in New Orleans. And if you put side by side these two cities, it is remarkable how the decline has paralleled each other. You can look at St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. I mean, there's a number of cities that have had these declines, a lot of them related to either the economy, industry, or what have you. And you know, Philadelphia, from worst to first, you know, kind of city and population, and Center City in particular. New Orleans has had a great deal of revitalization and investment made after you know, the horrible event of Katrina, but they've had these, you know, kind of turning components. Some of them have been more organic than others. And, you know, that's, I guess, where Detroit differs. We had the same kind of declines, but we've been, I think, further in making, you know, behind in making that turn. And especially with the recession that we just went through and the massive loss of manufacturing jobs, that further delayed us, pushed us way back. And, you know, now, you know, we've caught our breath. We've made our turn, and we're starting to run as fast as we can. So,
great. What is the Detroit Investment Fund?
So the Detroit Investment Fund is a series of tools that we use for investing in commercial real estate, and I'm just going to say generically jobs in the city of Detroit and in the region. It really depends on the tool. Today, we have nine different tools with more in the wings, focused again in these two categories. Let me break it up for you in pieces. On the real estate side, we get involved from the very early stages, what we would call pre-development. This is where we're investing in potential projects, but the dollars that we're investing look at not the viability of the project, but the elements that we've got to complete to get to financing. In other words, do we have to complete our architectural engineering? Do we have to complete our legal work? Do we have to complete maybe the acquisition of certain other parcels to get the project to the point where it's financeable? And then we take that all the way down the continuum. We'll finance through construction, and then we provide gap financing. Well, what does that mean? That means that the owner of the project is bringing certain dollars to the project. You have the traditional sources, the banks and others that provide capital. And then often what we're left with in the city are gaps of financing. And so our job is to figure out how do we fill those gaps? What are the appropriate tools? How do we get all of this stuff kind of closed simultaneously so that we can move forward with a project? To do that, we had to create a whole variety of different tools. On the job side, we get involved with emerging companies all the way to what has been Detroit's bread and butter, you know, manufacturing, wholesale, distribution, and logistics companies. We have companies through a program called the First Step Fund that may even be pre-revenue, meaning that they're, you know, beyond an idea but before actually generating money through the business. We have an early stage venture capital fund called Detroit Innovate that focuses obviously on early stage companies but tends to be technology driven companies, high growth opportunities in that space. We have retail programs that focus on urban retail. So these are actually the retailers themselves that get financing. We are financing everything from the tenant improvements in space, inventory, just a whole variety of different things to ensure the success of independent retail. A very, very difficult space to participate. Hard to find what I would call more traditional sources, so we ended up creating some tools there. And then we have some tools and resources that bridge both spaces. So we have what we call new market tax credits, a federal tax credit that we can use to enhance or provide equity to projects. We can use that either on the operating side, the business side, job side, or we can use it on the commercial real estate side. A lot of flexibility with that particular tool. We have TA or technical assistance that we can provide to companies, which has impacts on both the real estate and on the companies themselves. So again, tools that help to ensure the success longer term. So just a whole variety of different bits and pieces. I'm going to take that one more rung down if that's okay. So we've got these tools and resources. We go to where the opportunities are. And in the case of commercial real estate, we really focus in on particular geographies. We've been focused for the last, I would say, 13 years on the corridor. This is the Woodward corridor I'm referencing from the river all the way up to the New Center area. Essentially, we used to say freeway to freeway, but the reality is it's broader than that. It's Corktown, it's Eastern Market, it's Lafayette Park, Woodbridge as a general rule. It's the areas that surround you know, kind of the Lodge and 75 corridors as well. But that's been our particular area of focus. Today, with the new framework that's been put out on Detroit Future City, we are now venturing off into the neighborhood. So we're in on the east side in West Village, we're in Southwest Detroit, we're in 6 Mile and Livernois, you know, kind of spaces, taking that next wave, and really excited about it. I mean, the fact that we can now move to the neighborhoods is terrific. So again, wide variety of tools, some of them very geographically focused. When we talk about the business side though, we really do go where the opportunities are. And on the business funds that we've put together, many of them are regional, especially our entrepreneurial tools. So we are kind of four county, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties as a particular area. The tools can technically do things in the state of Michigan, many of them, but our focus has really been, you know, kind of hyper-focus on Detroit, general focus on the region with the ability to go wider than that if we need to.
What year did the Detroit Investment Fund begin?
So, an easy question with a complicated answer. The first fund that was created by Detroit Renaissance, where I started, in 1995, and it was called the Detroit Investment Fund. And it was a private equity fund that was started with essentially the membership of Detroit Renaissance. So Detroit Renaissance member companies and individuals, I think there were 27 of them off the top of my head, they had raised approximately $48 million. There was it was a total of 52, but a portion of that was set aside for a very specific project. So I'm going to say roughly $48 million, which started that first fund. I went. Had the pleasure of working on that that original fund. It was part of that Bob Keller original agenda that was put together in 1993 as a concept. It was recommended by the board in 1994 and formed and funded in 1995. So it was a sounds like a couple of years, but it was really a relatively short time frame. And this was a double bottom line fund, and it was at the time pretty innovative. There were a few of them out there, but not a ton. And the double bottom line, today we hear a lot about triple bottom lines, but the double bottom line was you generate a return for your investors. That's one of them. And the other is that in our case, you would advance, you know, kind of the social or economic development components related to the city's revitalization. The triple bottom lines that we hear about add a third component, which is a green component, most typically to the fund. So we formed this double bottom line fund in 1995, and it went off to go do its work. But it had a few bumps and bruises that it took. It came out of the gate investing primarily in operating companies, had a fairly rough go of it, was making a switch to real estate, although still blending between real estate and commercial investment. And in 2001, the Detroit Investment Fund was making a leadership change. I was asked to go down the hall on an interim basis, you know, go down, keep the ship steered straight for a little while, and we're going to find new leadership, and I ended up never leaving. So that was terrific, and we had some work done with the Detroit Investment Fund. We brought in a guy named Mike Monahan. Mike was the president of Comerica Bank. Took a stint through Munder on his way to retirement, and another guy named Chip Miller. Chip was executive vice president at Standard Fed, ABN AMRO, and he was retiring after I think a few mergers had occurred over there. We were fortunate. Those were the two folks that were hired by the board to investigate the best possible future for the Detroit Investment Fund. So what came out of that was a recommendation to make deals bankable. Sounds pretty simple, right? You know, you want to leverage that owner equity position, as we talked about, till we merit bank or traditional financing. In other words, play the role of the gap. Don't be the bank, don't be the equity, play the gap role, and it's an appropriate role for us to play. So we were asked to stay on at the time. Roger Penske was chairing the fund. He had asked both Chip and I to stay on, and after some hem and hawing, we absolutely both agreed to take that on. And I would tell you at the time, Chip and I both felt that it would be a short-term, kind of investment in the process. We'd get all these dollars deployed in the short run, and here I sit, 13, almost 14 years later, just enjoying what's been built. So the Detroit Investment Fund was the first fund. We were then asked to take on as business leaders for Michigan was emerging out of Detroit Renaissance. They were going through their own organizational change. We assumed some of the nonprofit tools that they had around pre-development, land acquisition, and the like, brought those kind of under our care and feeding. They were still maintained physically at Detroit Renaissance, but we were managing them. In 2010, we formed our own foundation called Invest Detroit. And it was really to group all of these tools together and to create a single umbrella entity. The reality is folks don't care about the Woodward Quarter Development Fund or the Detroit Investment Fund or, you know, whatever fund we have by name. What they want to know is, do we have a resource that is going to solve their issue? Do we have a resource that's going to bridge the gap in their particular project? Or are there things that we can do to help them on the business side that are going to solve other challenges that they're experiencing? And so we went to, you know, this was a discussion around a house of brands or a branded house. And obviously we ended up with a branded house. We packed all of our tools underneath that. We actually ended up moving all of those nonprofit tools as Business Leaders was emerging from Detroit Renaissance to us. And then we started creating our own tools and resources under that umbrella. In 2011, we went for a designation under the Department of Treasury called CDFI. It allows you to apply for public loan tools and grants. CDFI stands for Community Development Financial Institution. And again, it's a designation. You've got to go through a pretty extensive process to get qualified as a CDFI. And then you renew that every 2 years or so that you've got to renew the status of that CDFI. But that was an important designation for us to pick up. It allowed us to access different tools and resources. Around that same time frame, we also started what they call a CDE, Community Development Entity, that was eligible to put in an application for new market tax credits. And so we went through that process and then submitted for some of these tax credits and were successful. So, you know, you look at us today and it looks like a whole bunch of bits and pieces, but they're behind all of that cloudiness, there really is some order and some specific intent behind those tools.
When did Detroit Renaissance become Business Leaders of Michigan, and why did the name change?
So I would have to double check on the exact date, but it had to be around that 2010-11 time frame is my guess. Again, I have to verify that, but I believe that that's about right. And the reason is, once again, we were catching up to where the rest of the United States had already moved to a large extent. The history had been that these civic, CEO-driven organizations focused primarily on their downtowns or their cities, their major urban cities, were formed. You know, this happened a lot in the 60s and 70s in particular, although you can find a much longer history of that kind of engagement of CEOs within their cities. The organizations across the country were starting to make a migration. In fact, I wrote a paper for Paul Hillegans, who was a president and CEO of Detroit Renaissance for a period of time as well. Terrific guy. I think add that value statement to it. Paul had asked me to do a paper on these other CEO organizations, best practices, where were they going. And directionally, and this is, I'm guessing, 98, 99, somewhere in that time frame, directionally, we had already seen a great deal of broadening in the agendas, broadening in the geographies. In many cases, we saw the CEO civic organization merging with the chamber-like organization, smaller businesses mixing with the bigger businesses and becoming a larger regional organization. So what was going on here was that BLM had started off as Detroit Renaissance, focused specifically on the city, really on its core, the city itself. Then it moved to kind of a regional focus as Detroit Renaissance. And then over time, moved to a statewide CEO-driven organization, and that's where Business Leaders for Michigan came in. That was under the leadership of Doug Rothwell. Doug today is the president CEO of Business Leaders and its predecessor, Detroit Renaissance. So he took it through that transformation into this new organization.
Thank you. What was the impact of Detroit Renaissance when you worked there in the late 1980s and early 1990s? And what is the impact of business leaders of Michigan now?
So very different agendas. And I'll add, if you don't mind, kind of a middle point to that. The first side of that, if we talk about the late 80s and the early 90s, we have to create some context for what the organization was doing. This organization really started to look at physical development. In fact, the building that we're looking at, you know, that we're sitting in here, the Renaissance Center, was an you know, kind of an outgrowth of the work that started in 1972, and the business community obviously wanted to make a substantial investment in the community, to try to, you know, reignite some of the development in the community. So when we got to the early 80s, the economy was in a horrible state. It didn't make a lot of sense to pursue these physical developments. And so what the organization did is it kind of reoriented itself to showcasing the city. This is my way of framing it, not necessarily what the minutes would reflect in the in their history. But showcasing meant, how do we highlight the city in its all of its glory, so that we can get both national and international recognition for this community? And that became these international events. When Grand Prix racing was brought here, it was brought as Formula One racing, an international racing event that brought people in from around the globe. The Montreux Detroit Jazz Festival was intended to really showcase Detroit's long history with jazz, and reflected another you know, kind of nationally or internationally recognized and internationally recognized jazz festival in Montreux, Switzerland. Freedom Festival and fireworks, obviously a great way to just to celebrate community and international community, being our, you know, our friends in Canada. But they're all ways to kind of highlight the city, put it in a good framing and the like. And I think that that just kind of carried on through the 80s, as it was very difficult to take on some of the physical development, you know, elements that that were part of its history. So that brought us up to the early 90s. Change in leadership always means, especially in a smaller organization, major change in agendas, and Bob Keller came in, and again it was focused on economic development, physical development, and public policy. Bob Keller viewed those as a three-legged stool, and that became the drivers, which meant that by definition we were going to move beyond just the elements that were put in place, and in fact divest ourselves of these special events and focus on rebuilding, if you will, community. Today, business leaders has really been has become a very significant public policy focused statewide organization. The Michigan Turnaround Plan, I think, has been a strong influencer to public policy here in the state. If you look at what's happened around tax structure and the like, business environment elements, and how we are focused on a comparative basis, I think that that organization's done a terrific job of, first of all, refining, defining that agenda, and then just you know, doing a terrific job on the implementation of that agenda. So that continues on. They just ran a new version of the Michigan Turnaround Plan, and you know, kind of the next wave. And I expect that they'll continue to have strong discipline around that that implementation.
What do you feel is the greatest accomplishment that you achieved while working with Detroit Renaissance?
Wow. There's lots to choose from there. That's a terrific question. I think, you know, sometimes it's the simple things that just keep on giving. The creation of some of the smaller loan programs, especially the ones that focused on early stage development, physical development. I mentioned one of the funds, Glenn Lapin and I both worked on the pre-development fund that was created. It was created in support by a foundation here in the area called Hudson Weber. And they seeded this pre-development fund. Glenn kind of started the process. I got engaged in the, I think right after its funding. And then we shaped that tool that is still a very successful tool today. And I think you can trace a lot of the growth and development in Midtown and Downtown to the investments that were made two decades ago.
You had mentioned a Mr. Glenn Weber. Could you please?
Glenn Weber?
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Lapin? Sorry.
No, it's not a problem. I believe I must have misheard you then. I thought you had mentioned working with a Mr. Glenn Weber.
No, Hudson Weber was the foundation that that helped fund a fund that Glenn Lapin. And I might have said I absolutely might have said Glenn Weber, but I apologize if that's the case.
No, not a problem. Thank you for the correction. What was one of the most memorable projects that you worked on with Detroit Renaissance, as opposed to the greatest accomplishments that you had while working with Detroit Renaissance?
Let me think about that for a second, because we had just a terrific amount. I mean, honestly, I think that for me, from a programmatic perspective, it was the creation of the Detroit Investment Fund. And, you know, I'm working on that was, I got to work on that directly with Bob Keller. That was, you know, a project that that I took on. And I think that that's had probably, obviously it's had big impact on my own career and future. And that was the basis for everything that's Invest Detroit today.
My final question for you is, what projects would you like to see fully realized before you decide to retire, and what do you see as your next step?
So that's a terrific question. For me, you know, what does success look like? It's truly the revitalization of the city. Well, what does that mean? That means really the repopulation of the city of Detroit. New retail, new commercial, new opportunities. But the best way I think that gets translated and the heaviest lifting that we have to do today is around Detroit's neighborhoods. If you look at Detroit's history, you know, we've had these strong neighborhoods, a lot of annexation that took place in the 20s and 30s, but these strong communities that have always been a part of the backbone of this great city. And when you drive, you know, some of our challenged neighborhoods today, it's hard to envision, you know, the absolute revitalization of those particular areas. To me, it really, you can have different commercial components, you can have different things kind of come in and out, but it ultimately, for me, success is going to be measured by the vibrancy of the neighborhoods.
You mentioned this vibrancy of the neighborhoods and the revitalization of them. Which communities do you see as being the backbones for this revitalization?
Well, that's a simple question, but a tough, again, a tough answer. There are so many historic neighborhoods across the city. I don't know that if we selected three of them, that would be, at least in my mind, what success looks like. I think when we talk about success for the city, we really do need to see all boats raised by a tide that is moving in and that everyone has the opportunity to benefit from. If you start thinking about density from our perspective, that means, you know, really increasing. It's the same as the mayor has put out his, you know, he's got one metric, and that is the increase in population. I think from our perspective, we would follow that same basic belief that this is really dependent on population. When you start thinking about what that means in neighborhoods, it means, you know, a diversity in incomes. It means being able to rebuild much of the commercial corridors. It means close proximity to jobs, means good public transportation, but more generally, good mobility. It's all of those elements. It's what you see in highly functioning cities today. We have a lot of those ingredients in place, but we have to have that as a benefit to the entire community, not just to kind of the midtown, downtown areas. We have to see that expand and grow to include all 140 square miles.
Well, how do you see the Detroit Investment Fund and Detroit Renaissance contributing towards the city's growth moving forward?
So, business leaders today, formerly Detroit Renaissance, will continue to provide good direction on public policy, good agendas around Michigan's turnaround, primarily focused on the commercial sector, I think. Invest Detroit will do, I think, what it's really positioned itself to do, and that's to focus on targeted geographic areas for revitalization, and in all respects. That means, you know, commercial, retail, and residential. And I think on the job side, we're going to continue to invest in the very early to very late stage companies. We'll probably continue to add new tools to support that growth and development. But that is our intent. We think that we're having a positive influence on the market, and the more we can get out there and work, the more we can be part of its success. So that I think it's going to be more of the same for us right now.
You had mentioned Michigan turnaround. You've mentioned that a couple of times. What does that mean to you? What does Michigan turnaround mean?
Well, you know, the first Michigan turnaround plan that was put forth by Business Leaders for Michigan was put, you know, out at a time when we had seen a pretty significant decline in our commercial, you know, sector, and was really focused on how do we make this a more attractive place for businesses as a general rule. There are many other aspects to the plan and some very specific programmatic outputs that they put in there, but the general, you know, focus was on creating a very strong business environment, and I think that they've been very successful at implementing the specific aspects of those plans, the items that they identified in those plans. And as I mentioned, they just put forth their next wave or next version of the Michigan turnaround, which gives us our next list of instructions to focus on. There, I do think it's important that we continue to make good forward progress on the commercial side, because there's always a strong balance between the commercial and the physical, you know, kind of components. Jobs are just, you know, fundamentally important to development.
Is there anything else that you would like to mention about what it was like for you working with Detroit Renaissance that we haven't already covered?
No, I mean, it was a terrific honor to be able to work for an organization, one with the history that it had. Two, while we didn't really talk about this, the board membership that it had, when you think about folks like Roger Penske, Max Fisher, Al Taubman, Peter Stroh, I mean, to be in the same room with these really terrific minds and leaders of industry and corporations, it was a terrific honor. There's a lot that I've learned just to, you know, being allowed to be a fly on the wall for the early years, and then to actually participate in some of the programmatic stuff. It was terrific, you know, a terrific experience. They've always provided me with opportunities beyond what I thought I was capable of at the time, and I'm always going to be most appreciative of that that opportunity. As I mentioned on the front side of this discussion, this really has been a career of you know, of opportunity and serendipity for me, and Detroit Renaissance really made all of that possible.
I do have a follow-up question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned being in a room with gentlemen such as Max Fisher and the like. What was that like for you, coming into a room with that?
Well, the first few times going into a room like that was incredibly intimidating. You know, again, these were folks that I had read about, that I had you know, done case reviews and, you know, in class, you know, on a number of these folks, the legend of some of their deals, et cetera, investments, what have you. It was intimidating, and then I had the you know, kind of the privilege or the pleasure of learning what great personalities some of these folks had. If you know, of course, part and parcel to their success in some cases, but and a hugely diverse group of folk too. I mean, we had the banks, the utilities, the auto companies, retailers. You know, just a really diverse group of folk. And then over time, when you think about that from a resource perspective, where else can you find those kind of access points than with these kind of special organizations? So I think it truly was a unique and special time frame, and I think it survived much longer than many of those organizations. Today, business leaders, you know, same kind of composition. In fact, even larger, they're probably up to around 80 members today of CEOs from across this this state, you know, and we are truly blessed to have that level of corporate engagement around around our own futures.
Well, thank you so much for meeting with me today, and you have a very lovely evening.
You do the same. Thanks so much.